A statewide commission is wrapping up its second major report in response to the tragedy at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. And an increase in vacation home rentals is bringing changes to the Florida Keys. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm Danny Rivero, filling in for Tom Hudson this week. Armed teachers, police officers in every school in the state. A new database meant to identify students that could pose a risk to their fellow classmates. The Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Commission had a hand in all of these developments. Soon, the commission will issue a new report with new school safety recommendations for the legislature. What should we expect? And a new report finds that the Florida Keys is a hotspot for short-term vacation rentals. But what does this mean for the residents and the culture of the Keys? All of that coming up next on a pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Made possible by Willie the Bee-Man, Bee Removal Specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Danny Rivero. Tom Hudson is off this week. The State Commission investigating the Parkland shooting is coming out with a new report outlining more school safety recommendations. The Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Commission met near Orlando for 2 days this week. It was their final meeting before submitting their second report to the governor's office. That's set for November 1st. I spoke with one of the commission members, Polk County Sheriff Grady Judd, about what's going in the new report and where efforts stand to protect Florida schools. The Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Commission met again this week to talk about its second report, and that report's due on November 1st. What will the second report have that the first report didn't touch on?
We're going to talk about mental health. We don't have sufficient mental health funding any place in the state for anyone of any age. Normal people don't shoot up schools, houses of worship, or places of employment. So what we know is that we have to get in early. If you see something, hear something, say something. Okay, so you do that. And law enforcement arrives. Great. We find people in crisis. We Baker Act them. Then what? We want to make sure that there's not only services, but robust services to help those who are in mental health crisis, to help those that we believe may have a proclivity to do a horrific act, such as be an active shooter. The goal of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Commission is not only to investigate that horrible tragedy, that horrible massacre by that evil person, but to see what we can do better. What best practices can we put in place to reduce the probabilities, one, of an event occurring, and two, if it does, to mitigate damages.
Sheriff, when you read through the findings that the commission has made, it's overwhelmingly clear that the majority of the persistent issues with school safety are happening specifically in Broward County, of course, where the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School is located. What makes Broward County such a problem area in the state when it comes to these issues of school safety?
It is just beyond all understanding of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Commission of how, of all the places in the state of Florida, you can have pushback. Some of the greatest pushback we're getting while trying to keep children safe is in Broward County, Florida, ground zero, where the horrible tragedy occurred. Let me get this straight. Residents of Broward County, those that you elect are not taking a leadership position, they're not showing a sense of urgency, and they're not working to make sure your children are as safe in school as they could be or should be. But I can tell you one of them that I've taken a personal interest in is the failure for the Broward County Commission and the Hollywood City Commissioners to build out a much-needed radio tower in Hollywood to ensure safety and security of not only first responders, but to make sure that we can deliver the appropriate services to those that may be in need. We have watched this over and over in the news. We have brought representatives in to speak before the commission. And quite frankly, I am very frustrated. So one of my requests to put in our report is that the state of Florida passed legislation that says, look, when a government such as the Broward County Commission or the Hollywood City Commission, when they're at loggerheads over a piece of technological equipment to keep people safe, that at that point in time, when they can't come to a satisfactory resolution in the best interest of keeping people safe, the state legislature will allow the governor to step in and build the tower.
The commission is also set to recommend changes to state law to make it clear that only sheriffs can train someone for the Guardian program. And of course, that's the program that allows school officials to be armed on campus. Has there been any confusion about this leading up to this recommendation?
There's not been any confusion by the commission. There has been one event that occurred in Palm Beach County where a private organization decided that they too could train guardians. Clearly, from the very beginning, because I was involved in the discussion from the very beginning, because the Guardian program that's inculcated in state law is a Sentinel program that my training team designed here years ago. They changed the name of it, added 12 hours to their curriculum, and put it in place. I was involved with Governor Scott and the leadership in the House and the Senate. Clearly, it was never the intent for a private firm to be able to train and certify guardians, and they can't by law. But as with all laws, there's some lawyers involved in this event that are wordsmithing and crafting some small modicum of doubt. So we're only wanting to clean up the language.
One of the recommendations in the draft report that will be coming out is that all incidents of fighting or physical violence in schools have to be reported to and documented by law enforcement, no matter how serious the incident. Why is a measure like that necessary right now?
Do you know that's not the intent of the report? And we had a specific conversation about that. In fact, I brought the question up. What they're saying is, if you're going to have a diversion program, criminal acts that are going to be diverted, whether during a diversion program created by the school or the district, or one created by the state or the county, those diversions from criminal events have to be placed in the prevention web. And understand, the prevention web was created so that they didn't get arrested and go into the criminal justice system before they were diverted out. So at the end of the day, our desire is not that two kids push each other in the hallway, which illustrates a battery. Nobody's hurt. The teacher breaks it up, says, hey, go your separate ways. Our intent is not for that to go in the prevention web. It's not to be documented as a criminal event at all. What we're saying is, if you have a diversion program, you have to put the pre-arrest diverted kids in the prevention web. And the reason for that is so we can track that child to see if they have some issues that need mental health help, or are they repeatedly creating issues that should be a precursor or a warning that more violent action is on the way.
Sheriff, this topic of how police address incidents in school, not mass shootings, but you know, events of people pushing or possibly punching each other in school, this speaks to a concern that many advocates have voiced since the beginning of the commission. Fears that the commission could possibly overcorrect in what it's trying to address, and that push to prevent mass school shootings, that it might lead to criminalization and over-policing of schools. How are you guys making sure that you aren't doing exactly just that?
Yeah, that's just not accurate. And anyone who suggests that is being disingenuous, because we have had an active move in the state of Florida for the last few years to do pre-arrest diversions on minor violations of law for the benefit of the child. And the majority of these events are dealt with as disciplinary actions by the schools. They're not even brought to law enforcement's attention. If anyone suggest the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Commission is doing anything other than trying to find those that have a proclivity to be an active shooter and get them services in advance so that it doesn't manifest to a shooting, they're just being disingenuous. This has nothing to do with the normal day-to-day discipline and or criminal activity that may arise from people attending school. This is designed specifically so we can ferret out the Nicholas Cruises in advance and make sure that they're not caught up in silos so that we don't discover their horrible criminal history, their horrible mental health history after the fact, but well before the fact, so that they can receive help. That's our only interest.
Well, thank you so much for taking a bit of time and talking with us, Sheriff. I really, truly appreciate it.
Sure, you're sure welcome. Take care.
That was Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Commission member, Polk County Sheriff Grady Judd. Still to come, we'll continue our conversation on school safety almost 2 years after the Parkland shooting. Stay tuned. You're listening to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Danny Rivero, filling in for Tom Hudson this week. The State Commission looking into the Parkland shooting is wrapping up a second report. It'll recommend more school safety measures to the state legislature. Earlier, we spoke with Polk County Sheriff Grady Judd. He serves on the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Commission. He talked about the challenges faced by certain communities, namely Broward County, where Parkland is located. This also comes as the Florida Senate prepares to decide whether Broward's former sheriff, Scott Israel, gets his job back. He was suspended by the governor earlier this year over the agency's response to the February 14th shooting. WLRN's Broward reporter Katie Switalski joins us now to break this all down.
Hi, Danny.
Hey, Katie. So, Katie, in the last segment, we heard from Polk County Sheriff Grady Judd about some of the new recommendations that we're expecting to see from this new report. And you've been covering these commission hearings since they started last year. Do you have anything to add about something that the sheriff said?
Well, he got a lot right in terms of what he said was very representative of what we've been hearing from not just him, but the other commissioners since this all started. I mean, everything that he talked about is in line and in tone with what the whole commission feels. So I really feel like he represented the entire commission when he talked about that. Now, one of the things he mentioned, the commission this time around is really concerned about Baker acting, which is when someone is involuntarily taken in for a mental health examination. And this is really one of the first times that the commission has been concerned about mental health. Now, they admitted in the first report, there's a few lines in there where they say, basically, mental health issues are too complicated. We'll get into it later. And later is now. So one of the things you're going to see in the second report is they dabble into mental health recommendations. They really say that Florida's mental health system is underfunded, but they don't recommend how much to increase funding by at the state level. So it's kind of like a blanket. We see that there's a problem. We think there should be more money put at it, but they don't say how much or necessarily how. One of the interesting parts of that is because there's a lot of law enforcement on the commission, the commission's chair, Bob Gualtieri from Pinellas County, really sort of talked about Baker acting in terms of law enforcement practices. So a lot of times law enforcement is the agency that's doing the Baker acting, and there's been a culture push to Baker act instead of arrest, widely across the state of Florida. So one of the things the commission is talking about is how do we hit that nuanced culture change that needs to occur at what your everyday police officer is getting told.
And I'll add some context to that. I mean, the police officers having to respond in Baker Act is, in fact, a result of a poorly funded mental health care system. Yeah, they're picking up a lot of the slack. So the commission's not recommending a specific number, but they're just saying
we need more money into the system in the first place.
We need more money into the whole system in the first place. They're, you know, and that should be said, that's not just in schools necessarily. Mm-hmm. But they did actually talk specifically about not putting all of this onus on schools for once. Most of their recommendations are things that need to change policy-wise in schools. And so it was really interesting to see them sort of divert from that a little bit and talk about a system as a whole and how to stop putting pressure on schools. I think that's one of the big things they were worried about in terms of, okay, we've thrown a lot of changes at schools that they have to get into compliance with. And really, I mean, most of this year they've been talking about compliance issues with schools not complying with safety requirements. So for them to say, okay, we need to wait and see if everything that we've put on them sticks was a new take.
So I want to take a second to back up. So the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School Public Safety Commission was created last year after the tragedy in Parkland. What has the commission's impact been on normal, you know, Floridians and school children?
More than people know, I think. And a lot of people have been asking me, okay, we get it. There's a statewide commission. They're making recommendations. What does it mean for me in my life? They actually have a lot of authority over everyday families and their children's experiences at school. So code red drills. This time around, they realized, hey, we probably required too many code red drills. Let's scale that back a little bit. And now they're going to move code red drills from once a month to 6 times a year. That's a big change. They're kind of seeing what worked the first time in their first report out in January and what they need to modify going forward. But they actually, I mean, their recommendations for how schools get hardened, what schools need to invest their money in terms of security equipment, that all comes from this commission. Because what they bring to the state legislature, the legislature has adopted so far. So they're the body that's advising the legislature on school policy moving forward.
All of which indicates that we should take the second report pretty seriously, because a lot of what went into the first report actually was acted on and signed by the governor.
Correct.
So the is it too early at this point to say what the commission's legacy is going to be? Or is this kind of something that's you know, the ball's rolling right now?
It's evolving still, but I don't think it's unfair to say the commission has two roles, one of which is pretty much already completed. They were tasked with investigating every single detail of what led up to what happened on February 14th, 2018, and the aftermath of the shooting. They examined and researched all of that. They put together a report with the findings of that investigation on here's what happened that day. But since then, they've moved into this role of looking at larger school policy, school safety hardening, school security. And now they've moved into this like advisory body role of talking to the legislature about what public schools and charter schools in the state of Florida need to do and be like and look like in case anything like this happens again. And I think their big legacy is they admit that they really don't feel like they can stop the next school shooting, but their goal is to make sure that all adults on the education and law enforcement sides are trained, and also to mitigate as much as possible the amount of people that could get harmed in a situation like that.
So, Katie, a few reports recently have come out casting some doubt on the work that the commission has been doing and on the actual makeup of the commission itself. In those two reports, they came out earlier this week from the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Aspen Institute. Can you tell us a little bit about the pushback that the commission has been getting?
And they've been getting some pushback for a while. They have their critics. The commission is not a diverse commission in that they don't have any students or current educators. No one on the commission is specifically advocating for students who have disabilities, and they don't have any voting members that are people of color. So we've heard in public comment for a few months now, hey, your policies affect me. Why don't I see anyone that looks like me making these decisions? And that's been a big criticism. And so I think that's the bulk of the report from the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Aspen Institute, that there's no gatekeeper to prevent against biases. And so one of the things they're recommending is that there be some sort of mechanism put in place to prevent from prejudices.
You're listening to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Danny Rivero. Katie, switching gears a little bit here, one of the most divisive characters in the aftermath of this tragedy has been the former Broward County Sheriff Scott Israel. He was removed from office from Governor Ron DeSantis shortly after he came into office, and the sheriff has pushed back on that. Next week in the Florida Senate, they're going to be holding a special session to talk about Sheriff Israel's removal. What can we expect to get in, out of that and to hear in that?
Well, first, this Senate-only special session is a pretty big deal. The last time this happened was in 1974. And the only reason that the Senate can do this is to talk about reinstating or removing a public official from office. So we've seen Scott Israel really push to get his job back ever since pretty much he was taken out in, well, I want to say it was January 11th, to be exact. But he has really been fighting what he considers a large injustice. And he's really not backed by residents in the community. I mean, Parkland families are very upset that this is being considered. And it puts the Senate in a weird position because their special master, sort of the person that recommends to the Senate, hey, this is what I think you all should do, is saying reinstate him. We can't pin all of this neglect of duty and incompetence on Scott Israel. Now, granted, when he was suspended, it was not just for the Parkland school shooting, but there were also references to when things went wrong communication-wise during the 2017 shooting at the Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport. Mm-hmm. Now, the report from the Senate special master is saying we can't pin this all on one leader. I think he should be reinstated. Well, then you have the governor looking at the Senate saying, hey, I felt really strongly about this. It was one of my first acts as your governor, and I don't want him reinstated. So you've got the Senate in the middle of both of those. It was kind of like a push-pull. And what they do when they meet next week, we don't know. Now, next week, there's also another hearing for the confessed Parkland school shooter. And we learned yesterday that he finally has a trial date. Jury selection will start on January 27th. So a lot of things in this case and this situation, both things that affect everyday public schools and policy at your kid's school or anybody kid's school, that's changing. But so are the specifics of what happened that day in 2018.
And Sheriff Israel, can you just outline a little bit of for us the defenses that he's been using to back himself up? You know, he feels like that he was not removed for adequate reasons, that basically the governor shouldn't have done that. Can you just explain to us?
Yeah, he really feels like this was politically motivated. Governor Ron DeSantis is a Republican. Scott Israel ran as a Democrat. And to be an elected official who's removed from office is a pretty big deal in terms of Scott Israel feels like he was elected by the people to be in this position. And by being removed by a state authority is defying the will of the voters. So those are some of the bigger points. Absolutely.
And Sheriff Israel, he's not the only elected official in Broward County that was removed. There was also Brenda Snipes. So is there as a background, and I'm sorry, Brenda Snipes was the supervisor of elections for Broward County. For people that might support the sheriff, is there a feeling that Broward County is being used as a kind of a punching bag? I mean, when I was talking with Sheriff Judd in the segment before this, he was saying Broward County is it the singular basically issue with all these school safety issues?
It is interesting to hear all of the reports that the commission gets where the problems kind of stem from Broward County. Now, I will say Brenda Snipes and the election issues are separate.
Yes,
but in terms of Broward and the school issues that we've had, the commission's been open in saying, hey, look, when it comes to implementing all of the required changes that we had the legislature put forth, the ground zero for where this tragedy and massacre happened is the one that's slow to get organized. And I think that that's really sort of ignited an impassioned anger in the commission at, hey, look, we come here, we're here for you because of what you guys, you know, what happened here. Why are you the last in the state to get certain things in motion?
Which day next week does the Senate hearing start?
Starts on Monday. I know they're meeting Monday and Wednesday. They could meet all week. We might hear Wednesday. And it's going to be one of those decisions that that all of Broward County will be watching for. I know some Parkland families and families of victims are going to be in Tallahassee where the hearing is going to be taking place. But the whole county will be watching.
This is Katie Switalski, the Broward County reporter for WLRN. Still to come, we're shifting gears now a little bit, talking about vacation homes. A new report finds that the Florida Keys qualify as vacation home country. We'll get into what that means here on the South Florida Roundup. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Danny Rivero. Tom Hudson is off this week. Housing in the Florida Keys is limited and expensive. One contributing factor is the expansion of vacation home rentals thanks to sites like Airbnb and HomeAway.com. Two new studies show the impact that's having on the Keys. WLRN's Keys reporter Nancy Klingener tells us more about them. She joins us from her southernmost bureau in the studios of Key West. Hey, Nan.
Hi, Danny.
So Nan, these two reports just came out analyzing several things related to the Florida Keys and vacation homes. Can you tell us a little bit about what those reports said?
Yeah, one was a study commissioned by our local Tourist Development Council. That's the county agency that collects and distributes the extra tax that we collect on tourist lodging. So when you're in a hotel, you pay an extra tax. Most of that money goes to the Tourist Development Council, and they use it to promote the Keys, to promote special events, and to help support some capital projects that also benefit tourism, like museums and parks and stuff like that. And so they commissioned a report to just talk about what was going on with the vacation rental industry and how the Keys fit in. And they found it's really growing in popularity, and that the Keys were a really favored beach destination for people who were looking to rent a vacation home near a beach. The Keys ranked higher than some of the competitors, including Miami-Dade and Broward and Mexico and the Caribbean.
And what are the implications of some of that research that you know, this trend is on the rise and the more people are wanting to go to the Keys and rent a home rather than staying in a hotel?
Right. They said it poses a threat to the traditional lodging industry, which would be, you know, a hotel or motel. And so they just have to be aware of that and know that people are traveling and they're traveling with their family and they want a living room to hang out in and a kitchen to prepare meals and stuff like that. The implications, though, I mean, you don't really have to worry about starting a GoFundMe for the tourism industry in the Keys anytime soon. I was just looking at the most recent of those lodging tax receipts, and we're on track to set a record for this last fiscal year, and the September receipts aren't even in yet. And we regularly, the Keys regularly lead the state in both occupancies and room rates. So, I mean, anybody who's tried to book a room down here, especially during the tourist season, if you can find something for under $300, you're probably doing well.
So, Nan, these reports come on the you know, a couple years after Hurricane Irma left a lot of devastation in the Keys. There's a lack of housing that's ongoing. As I understand it, the cost of housing is steadily gone up. And I know just historically in other parts of the world, cities like Barcelona, places like Airbnb have come under a lot of criticism because the more incentivized people are to rent out homes that someone could actually live in and you know, charge higher rates for someone that's only staying for a month or so, the more expensive it gets for locals. Is that kind of an underlying concern with some of this too?
I would say that's the biggest concern because you're right. I mean, the Keys study found that you can rent a house, you know, for 40% more to a vacation as a vacation rental than you would rent it as a long-term person who lived and worked here. So, of course, a homeowner has an incentive to do that. It's very hard to limit that. We have restrictions for renting for less than a month in most of the Keys, but those restrictions are capped by a state law that says there can be no further restrictions placed on vacation rentals. Only the ones that were in place by 2011 are allowed. And as far as anything rented for 28 days or more, you know, all bets are off.
Is that something that that local governments have wished that they could move on in the Keys, that they haven't been able to because of that state restriction?
Absolutely. Yeah, they really feel like their hands are tied and there's not a lot they can do about that.
So if we look at it and we add kind of two to two together and look at the direction that some of this is pointing in, I mean, these websites, these home sharing things have been growing constantly. It makes me think of luxury destinations like Cape Cod, Nantucket, Hilton Head, really kind of exclusive places where there's not a whole lot of people that live there, but there is a lot of transient people that come in and out. Is that where the Keys are heading?
I would say we're already there, at least in parts of the Keys. It can feel that way. And there are times of year, the really slow season in September, when there just aren't a lot of people in town. And so you can see the effects of that and walk down the street and most of the houses are unoccupied. So, yeah, we're already there in some respects, for sure. And you mentioned Barcelona. It's interesting. There was that story in The New Yorker a couple months ago talking about Airbnb and its impact on Barcelona. And they talked about how Barcelona gets 20 million tourists with a population of just 1.6 million. And that's 12.5 tourists per resident, right?
What's that ratio in the Keys?
The Keys, we get 5 million tourists a year with 75,000 residents. So that's 66 tourists per resident. So, we're dealing with a huge impact because, of course, like everything, it's a very limited supply and it's a very high demand.
So you just mentioned the word season. I think some people in other parts of the country don't understand season, but we're about to get into season now, right? The cooler months. But with the increase in vacation home rentals and people wanting to come down for prolonged periods and all this tourism going to the Keys, is the season still a thing, or are you seeing still, slow times and really heavy times?
The only really slow time left, I would say, is September, just because kids are back in school, so families aren't traveling. And, I guess Europeans have gone back to work, so they're not traveling. But summer has certainly picked up quite a lot since I've lived here. We get a lot of, South Florida traffic. We get a lot of European traffic in the summer. There's the lobster season opening, which is always a big draw, and other events that bring people down. So it has become a year-round thing. I don't know how much the vacation rental industry plays into that, but certainly if you were coming down with a family, to spend a week or a month even fishing and diving, having a house would be a good way to do that.
Got it. Thanks. That's Nancy Klinginer. She's covering the Florida Keys for WLRN. Thanks for coming on, Nancy.
Thanks, Danny.
And so, finally on the roundup. Don't talk to me a bad word. Please don't talk to me a bad word. A sign of a good job market is when people quit their jobs for reasons like a bad boss. A new survey finds that about 60% of South Florida workers have quit rather than put up with bad management. That's about 10 percentage points higher than the national average. WLRN asked listeners to share their stories of the office. We heard from Nora Huaroto from Boca Raton.
And it started basically the first day that I was there. It's like she would come to the desk and organize the desk, my desk, the way she wanted it to be. It was, let's say, I was on the phone and she would be like interrupting me. Who are you talking to? Why are you saying this? She would read my emails. I think it was like a power thing for her, knowing that she was the boss. It was hard just to be there every day. I end up at the emergency room one time because I had a panic attack. So I would go to work every day with my chest hurting. I couldn't breathe. And I left at the end of March. But to be honest, even though I do not have the money, I do not regret leaving the company. I do not regret leaving her. I have got obligations to
keep, so be very careful when you speak. Huaroto is still looking for work. Good luck out there. You can still share your bad boss story. Send us a text at 786-786-7826 or find us on Facebook at the South Florida Roundup. That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup. The South Florida Roundup is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado is our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The director of radio operations is Peter J. Mayers. The show's technical supervisor is Richard Ives. I'm Danny Rivero, filling in for Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. The program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, bee removal specialist. Please don't talk to me a bad word. Don't